So today's lecture is on supporting business decision making. And this lecture is tied to the first chapter in the Decision Support Systems book. The first assertion I want to make is that if we want fact-based decision making, then we've got to give decision makers good information. Information that's relevant and timely and that's appropriately formatted to help them make good decisions. In the second slide, we see the definition of a decision support system, and this is the definition I use at dssresources.com. Decision support system is an interactive computer-based system or subsystem. So it may be part of a larger integrated system with a TPS, or there may be multiple decision support subsystems in a larger decision support environment. So it could be a system or a subsystem that we're going to look at and examine. It helps people use either communications technologies or large data sets or document databases or knowledge that we somehow put into a computer or quantitative models to identify and solve problems, sometimes complete decision process tasks like making a forecast or completing a form, and make decisions. A very general term for a whole category of systems. Ralph Sprague and Eric Carlson wrote a classic book in 1982 called Building Effective Decision Support Systems. And in that they defined DSS as comprising a class of information system that draws on transaction processing systems and interacts with the other parts of the overall information system to support the decision-making activities of managers and other knowledge workers in organization. For 25 years, since Sprague and Carlson, we've been working with a framework of decision support, and the work I've done builds on that framework of Sprague and Carlson and on the work of Stephen Alter, who developed a categorization of decision support systems, and you'll read about that in Chapter 1, and we'll touch on it. Decision support systems are ancillary or auxiliary systems. Okay? They are not intended to replace skilled decision makers. We still need to do training. We need to hire the best people to make the decisions that we can. We need to help them understand what the exceptions are. We need to train them to use decision support systems. We need to keep decision support systems up to date. The systems are not intended to replace skilled decision makers. We want to keep managers in the decision-making loop. The systems that we're going to talk about a little bit in this course that replace managers and other decision makers are called decision automation systems. They automate decision making in organizations. If we're thinking about building a decision support system, we want to check that two clear assumptions are met before we commence the project, before we do a feasibility study, before we try to figure out whether that system will give us benefits. The first is we need to determine that providing good information and analyses to managers will help make fact-based decisions. If it's not a decision where facts make a difference, then there's no point in providing computerized information. So, if good information is likely to improve decision making, that's the first check that we want to make. And then the second is the idea of acceptance. Managers need to feel that the computerized decision support is useful, that they want it, that it helps them do their job. So the assumptions, build DSS when good information is likely to improve decision making. Build DSS when managers need and want computerized decision support. If you can say both of those conditions or assumptions hold, then we should look at the feasibility of the intended project, the costs, the direct benefits, the indirect benefits, and whether we have the technical skills and the technologies to build what managers want? If you answer no to either one of those, we probably don't want to proceed with the project. Got an article at DSS Resources that talks about the history of decision support systems. Decision support systems go all the way back to at least the 1950s when we had some what were called management information systems, and we had the air defense system to protect the United States against incoming missiles from the Soviet Union, and we had a huge radar network in the United States. But the management use of computers traces its origins back to about 1966, when Michael Scott Morton, in his Harvard dissertation, his PhD dissertation in the business school at Harvard, built a decision support system for a large appliance manufacturing company based in Boston to help in production planning. That was the first business application of computers. The display screen alone for that system cost over $100,000. They used raster graphics and a light pen display. They used a 1200 baud modem to connect to a Unix system that was running the database. And it only had 48K of random access memory, and it was using a drum for storage. That was in 1966. His dissertation was accepted in 1967. He went on to become an associate dean at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he trained a lot of people in the area of decision support systems. From 1975 to 1980, we started to do a lot more with financial models and quantitative models. I mentioned Steve Alter. He did a dissertation at MIT with Scott Morton and Peter Keen in 1975, where he looked at over 52 decision support applications, and he categorized them. And we'll look at his categorization scheme in a minute. Some of the categories are still very good, but for today, I've tried to collapse some of those categories. So you can read about this. In the early 90s, we shifted to large databases, and we did a lot more with what I call data-driven decision support or business intelligence. People like Bill Inman and Ralph Kimball moved decision support and data warehousing into the mainstream and large corporations, Fortune 2000 companies, and they still have huge, tremendous data warehouses. By 1995, the shift was on to the World Wide Web and even larger multi-terabyte databases. By 1995, Walmart had the largest data warehouse in the world, and they've only gotten bigger than that as storage technology costs have fallen and our processing speeds have gotten better. By 2000, we started to have web hosting of decision support applications, a lot of things with portals and single sign-on security, and today, we're doing Web 2.0 for decision support, and we're doing the 3D web with virtual worlds as new frontiers, as well as portable computing technologies. We're delivering decision support to salespeople, managers, wherever they are in the whole world, whether it's with the World Wide Web or mobile devices, and you'll see just an increasing expansion of decision support in all aspects of companies that are Fortune 2000 or large distributed organizations. These may be off-the-shelf packages or they may be customized applications. But even with a custom-designed application, we use a development environment. We don't start in C and write decision support systems. We buy a tool from a vendor and we customize it, or we buy a vertical market application that we can then put in to help us with financial forecasting or with demand management in a hotel or whatever it is. Steve Alter, in his 1980 book, said that these systems are designed to facilitate the decision-making process, that means help, and support rather than automate decision-making, and I still adhere to that philosophy. I don't want to get rid of skilled decision-makers. I just want the batting average to improve. Managers make mistakes, and some are very costly. I want to reduce the number of costly mistakes, and I want to increase the number of correct decisions that are made at the operating and strategic level so that we get more correct decisions in organizations. Computer use will not get rid of all bad decisions. We just want to improve the overall effectiveness and efficiency of decision-making in an organization. And then he said the system should respond quickly to changing needs. The world is changing much faster today than it was in 1980. And our population in 2008 is at least 30% bigger than it was in 1980. Okay? At least 30% more people. The United States population, over 300 million. The global population, over 6.2 billion people. So there are a lot of decision makers out there, and they make decisions that impact our lives every day. Some other terms that are used, business intelligence, knowledge management. My website says that Power Enterprises is a second generation knowledge management company. And I kind of look at knowledge management as everything that we do with our websites and decision support. When we build decision support systems, we're trying to translate knowledge into tools to help decision makers make better decisions. So these are other tools that you'll see out there in the literature. Some characteristics of DSS. Some people look at it as a body of knowledge about how to make a certain kind of decision. Other people look at it as having a record-keeping function. We make a decision and we track it. To me, that's very minor. Some people emphasize how it structures decision-making. It provides a workflow, a process. Some of them do. They don't all do that. Decision-makers interact with it. The idea for almost 50 years is that we wanted systems that managers could actually use. Some managers are still very reluctant to use information technologies themselves, so they delegate it to a marketing analyst or an administrative assistant. Facilitation, we've talked about that three times now. We want to help make decisions. Ancillary, again, we've talked about that three times. These are systems that are there as an adjunct. The human still makes the final decision. The computer doesn't say, you must do this. The computer provides analysis and information that helps the decision maker make a choice. Decision support systems are for repeated use, not just one-time use. That's why we can invest a lot of money in the user interface. It may be used daily or weekly or monthly, but there is a clear path of repeated use and oftentimes multiple users of the same decision support system. They're task-oriented. The decision support system has a particular task that it supports, a particular decision process that it's embedded in. We can identify them, and we hope that the system has a positive decision impact. It may improve accuracy. It may improve the timeliness of decisions. It may improve the quality or the overall effectiveness. A major metric that we use with decision support is, have we reduced the cycle time to make the decision? From the time the need for a decision was identified till a final choice was made. The world is speeding up, and if information technologies can help us respond faster and make the same quality or better quality decisions faster, we have an advantage over our competitors who don't use the technologies. As with most information systems, we want to get the right information that's accurate, relevant, and complete in the hands of the decision makers. We want to get it to them at the right time when they need it, whether they're an operational decision maker interacting with a customer, or whether it's a manager who's controlling operations, or a flight controller who's bringing planes in, or it's somebody who's making human resource decisions. We want to get it to them in a timely fashion. We want it in the right format, and more that means web-based, that they can access it from a web browser anywhere, and they can change whether they see a graph or a table or what variables. So we give them pull-down menus, and we try to allow the decision maker to have the data in a way that helps them see what's going on. And then the last one that we often forget is that we want to deliver it at the right cost. Some things that we could do with technologies cost a lot and give us very little benefits. We don't want to do those things. So everything we can do to support a decision maker is not at the right cost. Now, costs have fallen tremendously, and our skill has expanded. So we provide a lot more decision support in 2008 than at any time in history. The cost of the technologies and the networking has gone down. The cost of development has gone down. We have much more reuse. We have good development packages. But just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it. Hopefully you saw that with the assignment of people to teams. There's still a place for paper data gathering and paper sorting into categories for one-time use. Decision support systems are for repeated use, and we hope that multiple decision makers will use it, because that spreads the cost among many users, so we get that doubling of the benefit, or the multiplier effect. Is it DSS and MIS? Well, we call our major MIS major, okay? Some universities talk about an IT major or IS. The term MIS has not been used too much in the practitioner community since the early 1980s. What were management information systems in the 1960s and 1970s and early 80s? Today I call them data-driven decision support systems, and some people call them business intelligence systems. Some people call them report and query systems. They generate reports if they're paper reports. They are business intelligence systems if they're on the web with a web front end. So data-driven DSS today meet the minimal management reporting needs, but they can do so much more. And data-driven DSS try to help us get a historical perspective on our business operations on different metrics, whether it's financial or sales or product categories or customers. So we've got much more sophisticated understanding of our historical data today with data-driven DSS than we ever did with MIS. I may use the term MIS once in a while. It still floats into my discussion. But I'll use decision support systems as this broad category, and that's what we're going to focus on. And you'll see every decision support system is not the same. A data-driven decision support system is very different than a model-driven decision support system. Well, we can divide the world of information systems into transaction processing systems, instructional systems, decision support systems. Some people might add a few other big, broad categories. But the one we've historically trained undergraduate information systems for is to build and manage transaction processing systems. If we train you as a DBA or a database developer, it's to record those transactions, what people buy, get it into the accounting systems. These are very important. Without good transaction processing, the organization doesn't function today. I read an estimate a few years ago that if we did not have computers for accounting and transaction processing, that we would need millions of additional accountants to keep paper records for all the transactions. And you know we can't afford that. And it wouldn't be timely. You would not get milk in the grocery store if we didn't have computers in 2008. If we were still doing business the way we did in 1950, we would not have a global economy. Most of us would have a much lower standard of living than we do today. And most of our business would be local or regional. The world would not be the same. So transaction processing is important. But we've gone beyond transaction processing. It's not enough just to record transactions, okay, and capture data, purchase data, order data, payment data, okay? These systems emphasize data integrity and consistency, getting the correct data into our systems. And that's very important, and that's why we teach you about normalization. That's why we teach you about data validation. That's why we look at error checking and all sorts of things when we teach database. But today, we want to go beyond transaction processing and expediting and automating our record keeping. Okay? And we want to move towards decision support and intelligence about our business operations. We take data from operational systems or transaction processing systems and we move it into historical databases. Transaction processing systems in general don't keep much history. Okay, some do it more now, but we still get some advantages to having a separate database for historical information because we're not then going to slow down the transaction processing systems when we do historical queries. So we want to separate out decision support queries from one database if we're doing data-driven decision support from transaction processing queries. Plus, you'll learn as we talk about data-driven decision support that there are certain queries we don't do. We do not do update or add queries or in decision support. All we do are select queries. If you understand select queries, you can understand data-driven decision support. Because it's a historical record, we don't want it to change. But you have to understand select really well. So DSS are designed to aid in decision-making tasks and decision implementation. Not all of them are data-intensive.
They're certainly not all data-driven, and they don't all draw from transaction processing systems. Some decision support systems are oriented towards helping us envision the future and forecast the future and model the future. And those are the ones that are really exciting, when we can get a better idea of how our actions today may influence consequences tomorrow. Well, Steve Alter, in his book, came up with the following seven categories.
His first three categories, file drawer data analysis and analysis information system, are what I call data-driven decision support systems. Then he talks about financial models, representational models, and optimization. I call these model-driven, and this is a pretty technical term. These are simulation models. They represent reality. Okay, and simulation has gotten a lot better than it was in the late 1970s. We have very realistic simulations now. And then he talked about congestion models that use very primitive AI technologies in the late 70s. And those are much more sophisticated today than I call them knowledge-driven systems.
The framework that I've been advocating for a number of years has a dominant component, the driver of decision support, and three secondary dimensions. Who's going to use the system, the intended or targeted user, the purpose of the system? Is it for the purpose to help in patient care? Is the purpose to help in cost estimation for a single family resident? So what's the purpose of the system? And then the enabling or deployment technology. And a lot of this today is either spreadsheets or the web. That's how we develop and enable decision support today. So in terms of the dominant component that provides the functionality, it may be communications technologies, data and data management technologies, document and document management, knowledge base and knowledge processing, or models and model processing. These dominant components lead to the five categories. Communications-driven DSS, these are systems that help people collaborate and communicate in decision making. In the late 1970s, we didn't have tools to do that. We didn't have email. We didn't have video conferencing. Today we have video conferencing over IP. We have voice over IP. We have collaborative environments. We have collaborative workspaces. We have social networking. Today we have lots of possibilities for communications-driven decision support systems that we never had when we were initially building decision support systems in the 1970s. Data-driven systems, the simplest ones are just reporting, report and query. We set up a standard query. You do that in Microsoft Access. You create a query, you create a report, you run the query, you populate the report, you print it out. We still do too many paper reports, but those are the simplest data-driven systems. And when we teach information systems 080, a number of the exercises are just simple report applications out of Access. You learn how to make the report look nice with headings, and you bring in the fields, and you categorize them and do things like that. There's still a lot of that in business, But we've got more sophisticated systems that display data on maps or for executives in easy-to-use charts or pivot tables or drill down. Document-driven, it's really only become possible in the last 12 or 13 years as we got more accessible document databases with the web, where we store the documents as PDF, or we store them as HTML files, or we store them as images. So our document decision support is a lot more sophisticated today than it's ever been. Knowledge-driven, we use AI tools. We may also use some tools from data mining and then put the results into a system. The one I'll focus on the most is management expert systems. Model-driven, we use accounting models, financial models. In a model-driven DSS, we're trying to do what-if analysis and sensitivity analysis. Please note that. With model-driven DSS, we try to do what if we change this parameter, how sensitive is this variable if it changes in terms of the results of the analysis. The intended users may be customers and suppliers. It may be people internal to the organization or external. Purpose, we've talked about. It may be a function and very general, or it may be industry specific or a vertical market. So it may be an HR application. It may be a marketing decision support application for forecasting. It could be something for operations like airline customer service. We have lots of different purposes for decision support systems. The enabling technology, web-based is where it is, and we're moving the web to Web 2.0, and we're distributing the web to mobile devices. Whether it's your iPhone, or it's the new Google phone, or what it is, but we're going to distribute decision support globally, and we're going to distribute to where people are. They won't have to have a computer that's connected to a hardwired network. So we may have a web-based data-driven DSS or a web-based model-driven DSS. In the next couple of minutes, I want to quickly go over the last slides here. On slide 19, you'll see some descriptions of specific DSS. These are all different. They have a different purpose, a different technology, and a different dominant component. So a web-based model-driven DSS for truck routing used by a dispatcher. That's a very different DSS than a personal computer-based model-driven DSS for planning supply chain activities used by a logistics staff. We could have a list of hundreds, if not thousands, of very different specific decision support systems. More than likely tens of thousands. So there are lots of very different decision support systems using this framework that we can talk about. Slide 20 shows us the components, the traditional historic components of a decision support system. The user interface is the most important component, and that may be a dialogue, an interaction with the computer, a map, it may be menus, it may be other kinds of representations like sliders, it may be through a web browser, but the user interface is very important for all five categories of decision support system. We put a lot of emphasis on the user interface because our users are not techies, they're managers. They're frontline operational personnel. We want the user interface to support their decision making and not overload them with too much information. And then we have some communications components, we have model components and database components, and the data may come from many sources, both in the company and outside of the company. So the user interface is the most important tool component, and we use a lot of different tools to build it. The database, both current and historical data, and we load that data, sometimes in real time, but usually it's a batch upload, maybe every day, maybe every 4 hours, maybe once a week. Depends on how current we need the data to be for decision support. We have very large databases. We may call them data warehouses or data marts. It depends on how focused they are, and we'll go into that in more detail. And the size of databases, just huge. You can get a 1 terabyte hard drive now for your personal computer. So we're talking about databases that are going to be 1 petabyte, 1,000 terabytes of data. The biggest databases,
at National Security Administration, at Walmart, at Bell, at AT&T, well over 500 terabytes of data. That's why we're all concerned about privacy and personal information, because the databases are becoming so extensive. If Google has 100,000 servers with data, that's a huge database they can tap. And they have every query that anybody has ever given to the Google search engine. They have it all archived. That's a huge database. They don't know your name, but they know the IP number that it came from. And they know the date and the time.
They yes. store all that?
Yep. How else are they going to be able to tell you how popular these things are? Well, that's why they have such huge server farms, why they're going to build a huge server farm out in western Iowa, so that they have rollover, because they have to make sure that those servers don't go down. But they do protect your privacy. They never associate your name with those queries. They associate your IP number so that they could do geographic targeting and things, but they don't associate your name. They don't know who made the query. Okay. And then analytical tools. And these are models where we can do what-if and sensitivity analysis. And then the architecture and networking. We are a networked world, and we're distributing network through Wi-Fi, through the wireless, through Bluetooth, but the world is networked. If you go and you look at the network maps, you'll see big gaps in places like Mongolia and Africa and certain parts of Western Russia, but the world is very heavily networked. I mean, there's hardly a place globally that you can go that you can't get some kind of an access with a satellite, if not with a land connection to the internet. And that's video and voice and data. The challenges. The technology is changing very rapidly. We've got managers as customers, and they're notoriously difficult and demanding. We still have to figure out how to allocate our resources and what to computerize, what data to use, how to present the data, and when to bring new technology in. A big part of what we have to do over the next 10 years is to re-implement many decision support systems that are legacy systems and that are out of date. And that's going to be a lot of work for all of us. Decision support is the Full Employment Act for IS people. We will not, in general, outsource decision support because it's so sensitive that managers may be able to outsource call centers and transaction processing, but decision support is so key to the competitive position of a firm that if you're going to build decision support, you need to keep it in-house. You have to keep it in-house. You can't run the risk that competitors are going to get access to either your data or your models or your decision support capabilities. So I don't even like it when they outsource it to their advertising agencies or external partners. There are some review questions. They're up on the web, and you can see them on slide number 26. There will be a quiz, and I guess we're done here with this, which is good timing. Please go to dssresources.com. I will show you Decision Support World and Second Life a little bit on Thursday, and we'll do an Excel exercise. Questions? Comments? Okay, we'll see if we can get this up as a podcast. I know I talked really rapidly. Lot to cover. And we'll see if we can make it available for those of you who have the time or patience to listen a second time. And Mark will hopefully be able to hear what we said. Thank you much.